Thanks again for listening to the Park Hills Podcast. If you want more information on things we're doing, go to parkhillschurch.com or the Park Hills Church app. So we're moving into 1 Peter 5, the end of this book.
Yeah, we're getting there.
It's almost done. And when I look at the first five verses, you know, we talked about this a little bit in the sermon, but the idea that I have in my mind is it's moving from speaking directly to the elders of the church, right? The leadership of the church. And then from that, sort of an exhortation to the whole church to live up to this, to be this. And it makes me think, one of the things that Peter is telling us, and we're going to wrap this up in the next podcast, but he's telling us, be who Christ wants you to be in the midst of the world that you're living. So part of what he's telling the elders is be an elder. Actually do the job. You know, you and I have both grown up in a world where we've watched pastors and elders and others fail. Sometimes it's even been people that we're either connected with or loosely connected with through another person. And it's always surprising, and it's always really hard, and it's really sad. And I think the challenge that comes out of this is just be who you're called to be. Don't deviate. Don't take yourself too seriously. Don't take yourself and make yourself so powerful that you can't fall. That's not possible, by the way. Don't, if you're going to lead people, don't do so in a compulsive way. Don't tell them what to do. But you also should do so willingly, just loving people, guiding them through. You know, don't domineer over them, but be an example. So there's all this back and forth of verses 2 through 4 of 1 Peter 5 that just make you say, okay, what Peter's saying is I want you to actually be what an elder is supposed to be. And Peter has done this for a while, so he knows what an elder is supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always wrestled, you know, you bring up like the people who have made poor decisions, and just as pastors ourselves, I've tried to look for that. Like, what is the one thing I can do to make sure that never becomes me? And, you know, I've had different ideas, and I don't even throughout time, but I don't even each one of them. Then you see someone who, you know, maybe did that and still made a bad decision. You know, thinking about like, well, as long as you have accountability people in your life who can speak into your life. And a lot of these people did. And then, well, as long as you just prayer. If you are a man of prayer, and then, you know, I know some guys recently who have fallen who had talked about having a very intense and personal prayer life. So,
right.
So I don't think I think what this 1 Peter 5 here is just talking about living out your calling.
Yep.
Like continuing to live out your calling. And that's not, it's not easy, but it's simple. So there is kind of that simple answer, but there's not an easy answer to it. It's not like, oh, as long as you just pray every morning before you do this, or as long as you read your Bible every day, you know, you won't fall into temptation.
Which I think is part of what verse 5 is telling us is remain humble, right? Be people who are clothed in humility. If you understand that Christ alone will not fail you, but you potentially will fail someone else, or someone else might fail you, it just puts you in a different spot. Like you start to think differently, you act differently, you're not who, you know, everybody sort of expects you to be. So I don't know. I try to live that out. I think you try to live that out. I don't know anybody on our staff who doesn't try to live that out.
Right.
We might joke with each other about things that, you know, I don't know, words like prideful, just like float around the office sometimes, you know, or that person's fooled themselves. Yeah. And we're all like, ha, 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 ha. But in reality.
Or Chris makes us call him doctor and bow to him.
I do with, you know, kiss. I walk into the room often and say, kiss the ring. And you guys don't do that because you're insubordinate and you all, no, I'm just kidding. But this idea of humility, it is the closest thing to the magic bullet. The problem is it really stinks.
Yeah.
Humility there's a lot of days in your life where you don't want to be humble. You want people to notice who you are. You want people to, you know, to act like you're something. You know, I don't know how many times I've been in a room with people and they're all talking about how great they are. And then I just want to say, well, I've done this, I've done that. You don't even know me, you know? And then later on in the conversation, they'll ask a question and I'll answer it and they'll go, wait, who are you? What are you doing here? You know, I don't know if you've ever had those moments, but it's just, they go, where is that coming from? And I'm like, well, it's been here the whole time. You just didn't care because you're wanting everyone to know how great you are, as opposed to just like treating everyone in the room like they're equals.
Yeah.
So with that said, I think it leads us into this idea that we're really going to launch into the rest of the podcast, which is if what Peter's telling us is elders are supposed to be who they're supposed to be, I think one of the things that, and I want us to say this quick, the word elder there is really a church leader. It doesn't necessarily mean an old person, although more likely I've noticed in my life, the Christians who are Christians for longer tend to be more humble. So there is an element of picking an elder as wise, and it being an actual old person sometimes is even wiser because they've gone mm-hmm. through the ringer a little bit. They've done some of that. But what Peter's telling people is, I want you to be who you're supposed to be. And what I find interesting is he is saying this in a culture that is completely combative to Christianity.
Yeah.
I mean, they are crucifying every leader they possibly can if they find out who they are. In fact, that's how Peter is going to die if the stories are true, right? He goes, they crucify him, and he says, I don't want to be crucified like my Lord, so they crucify him upside down. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of that's legend. We don't know what's true and what's not true, but I'm willing to go with it. I mean, that makes sense that Peter would do that.
Yeah.
So with that said, I think when I think about Peter's tenacity that I see in 1 Peter, he's telling us, live different within the culture. And to him, he wouldn't necessarily struggle with trying to sway the culture to his way he's not saying make the culture your own, because I don't know if Peter could even entertain in his mind what it would look like to win the culture over. Is that fair?
Yeah. Well, I think that's completely fair, because I think we forget that the culture that Peter wrote to is very different than the culture we live in today. You know, first century Roman culture. You got to remember, these people were not captured. What's the word? They were taken over by Rome.
Yeah, vassals.
Yeah, yeah. It was a vassal state. They had to pay taxes to Rome. They had to submit to Roman rules despite, not being Roman.
Yeah.
And so they had these people that were they were being oppressed by Rome, really, and they had no power to overturn any of that.
Right.
And so not only are they being culturally oppressed, but they're religiously oppressed too, because, you know, anytime you start talking about a new religion, Rome kind of said, you can practice your Judaism as long as it fits mm-hmm. within our rules and you pay your taxes. But now there's this new religion that is coming up and is saying you can't call Caesar king. You have this other king. You have this new kingdom.
Yeah.
In fact, your ruler met with one of our agents, one of our Roman governing agents named Pilate, and said that he's in a kingdom not of this world. And they're starting to say, wait a minute, this sounds like rebellion. And the worst thing you can do to Romans is rebel.
Sure.
Then they come in and they squash you. So yeah, there was no thought there that like, oh, we can change the government. It was, we can change individuals. We can reach individual people and share the good news of Jesus Christ. And then those individuals will come and then join a new community. So it wasn't only an individual focused. There was a very community focused culture.
Yeah.
But that community was built by reaching individual people, and the reason I use individual there is not by reaching systems.
Right.
Right. They weren't going to overturn systems necessarily.
Yeah. So when I read this, I'm totally with you. It makes a ton of sense then that you would tell the church leadership, be the elders you're supposed to be. Another way to say that is you're going to be swimming uphill, mm-hmm. right? Upstream. You're going to face the fiery trial. Even in the midst of the fiery trial, back to chapter 4, I want you to be humble. I want you to be the elders that you're called to be. In the midst of the fiery trial, it's going to be real easy for you who have gone through it to tell everybody else, no, I went through it, so you should follow me. Mm-hmm. I went through it, so you should go through it too, right? Fight your way through it. And it would be really easy to be a leader who's able to prop themselves up and be domineering.
Oh, yeah, I see.
To be difficult, to be powerful. And what some part of what Peter's saying is, no, that's not who you are, because Christ has already done that. Now, where this goes for us, and I think this is very important for the world that you and I are living in, to bring back up that article that we started with in the very beginning of the book, we are living in a culture that is unique to us in a number of different ways. and when I mean it, it's unique in the Western world, because even for the last couple hundred years, for the most part, the Western world didn't even realize why it was doing some of what it was doing, but it was mostly based on Judeo-Christian ethics.
Yeah. You look at, you know, I appreciate Greg Boyd's book, A Myth of a Christian Nation, where yeah. you can't really have a nation that's Christian. It's not a theocracy. So he's kind of pushing back on that idea. And, not but, but and, you can see a lot of Judeo-Christian ethics were written into
yes.
the way at least this country was founded, and a lot of other countries in a lot of their laws and politics and legislation has a very strong Judeo-Christian ethic.
Yes.
That's kind of built into the background of all those things, and that's unique. Sure, Constantine did it, mm-hmm. right? A couple other guys, but for the most part, across the world, there hasn't been such religious, well, I mean, I guess the Roman Catholic Church did it for a while too in some of theirs, but mm-hmm. But that's even just in certain parts of the world, not, you know, to have such a government that's so pro-Christian to a degree is unique to our time and our geography.
Well, and that's the thing that I think most people don't understand from history. The Roman Catholic Church is Western civilization.
Right.
Really, what we are is we're Protestants, but we broke away from that Roman Catholic tradition in the 1500s. But in that sense, it's still very much from the same mindset of we live in a culture that upholds Christ above all things. That's not to say everybody was actually a Christian. That's right. not to say everybody did these things. But, you know, the way that murder was judged, for example, in Western culture until very recently was really based on the Judeo-Christian ethic of yeah. sort of, you know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, that kind of idea. Now, granted, they're leaving out parts of Jesus's teaching. And what I find so interesting, and this is where we're making that transition, is even today, the people who are breaking away from the Judeo-Christian ethic are still claiming truths from the Judeo-Christian ethic as their foundation for why they hold to the value they do. For example, the immigration decision. Mm-hmm. Human life is incredibly valuable. It's so valuable that they deserve a home. They deserve a place to eat. They deserve a place to be. And Jesus told us to love everyone. And so they build it off of that. And then they're like, so this is what it's going to look like. And you go, whoa, I think there's a leap there that I'm not comfortable with. Or, ironically, there's so many different, but the death penalty discussion, for mm-hmm. example, I've heard so many people sort of say, well, every life is precious and it's valuable, so therefore the death penalty shouldn't be a thing. And I'm going, you're taking the parts of the Judeo-Christian ethic you like, you're leaving off the rest of it, and now you're saying, this is how we're going to live. This is what we're going to do. And then what's super ironic is then you can do that with the pro-choice movement, and it makes no sense, because then you're saying, wait, you're willing to fight for life in these areas. So the reason why I'm bringing all this up is—
Yeah, we call that syncretism, by the way. Yeah.
I'm with you. Yeah. Thank you for the big fancy word. The foundations have shaken a little bit in the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And this is the article that we started off the book with.
Right.
In 1994, there were some decisions made that sort of moved us into neutral world. And then there were some decisions made in 2014 that moved us into negative world. Mm-hmm. And that is the world's perspective of the Judeo-Christian ethic, or of Christendom in general, or Christianity in general, has moved from a positive view pre-1994. That's not to say that everybody was positive toward it,
right.
but it's saying, generally speaking, Western civilization had very little issue with Christianity. In fact, most people would have called themselves a Christian, and yeah. you would have gotten ahead by being a Christian. Moving then into the neutral world, where there's less of that, now we're in negative world, which I think is going to springboard us into a whole other conversation down the road. But let's just start there. Let's unpack these things, these different phases of culture or civilization, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. The article Chris is referring to is called The Three Worlds of Evangelicalism by Aaron Wren, R-E-N-N. So if you're interested, you know, you can just Google that. You can find it. Yep. And yeah, basically it makes the case that, yeah, pre-1994, and I think he's making the case that he's putting these dates in America. I don't know. Europe was probably a little bit ahead of these dates.
Yes.
So in the United States of America, and that idea of the West, yeah, it was actually very advantageous. If you weren't a Christian, didn't call yourself a Christian, it was harder to function in culture in the marketplace. And then based on some things. And you can read the article and how he makes that case. But yeah, 1994 to 2014, those 20 years, it was kind of neutral. It was, and he even talks about how the church responded, like this idea that fundamentalism was really strong because they could be, but then in this gap times, like this is where seeker sensitive came out. It's this idea that we expect most people, seeker sensitivity in that style of ministry, we expect people to be comfortable or want to go to church, so it's easier to bring them in, get them in the doors, and then evangelicalism kind of during that neutral time, it's like, well, we got to engage the culture. We got to be relevant. We got to be meaningful in culture because nobody's just going to wander into your doors because they think they should go to church. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how the evangelical church doesn't have a response yet to the current culture that we're in, where now it's actually negative. You know, I talked about this in a sermon a little bit ago about how more and more in our culture today, Christianity and the principles of the Gospels and the Bible are actually seen as evil.
Right.
Like in the past, they were good. And then for a time, it was like, oh, they were nice. Like, yeah, Jesus says good things. You know, if you're not a Christian, you're like, yeah, I can respect that guy. He's like trying to be helpful. And now if you're not a Christian, you look at Jesus and you're like, actually, some of the things that he was doing or some of the things that are in the Bible are actually evil. They're yes. wrong. They have to be fought against and removed from our culture and removed from society. And what this has all brought up in my mind, and Chris, you and I have been processing through this quite a bit, is I think what this has created in the church, in our church context, the broader church context, is there is a vastly different experience of our culture between the generation that were adults pre 1994, mm-hmm. the generation that kind of became adults in that interim neutral time, and then the generation that is becoming adults in the last 10 years. So this idea that I see different attitudes toward culture depending on where you kind of came of age and began interacting with culture in a mature adult-like way, there's a different reaction to what's happening to the people that are that kind of had that experience of Christianity as positive, and then those who actually have never had that experience. I think there's a tension there. Chris, are you seeing any of that tension?
Yeah, and I think that tension lives partly because of these markers. And so let's talk about those really briefly. Like, why is 1994 chosen in the article? Well, one reason is the moral majority, which is what it was really called in the 80s, right, led by Jerry Falwell and others, this idea of the religious right, the moral majority, that there was this decision made that the country needs to hold on to traditional values and needs to be, you know, church-going folk and everything needs to kind of go that way. The height of that was probably the mid-80s. 1976 was called the year of the evangelical because Jimmy Carter won the election and he was the first evangelical president. He was the first president to call himself that. That's not to say that he was actually the first evangelical, but that term was being used in the 1950s to describe a certain brand of Protestantism.
Right.
And by the time you get to 1994, there was a House of Representatives takeover in 1994, kind of in regard to Bill Clinton's presidency, where Newt Gingrich and others were riding the wave of the moral majority without holding the values of the moral majority. Does that make sense to some extent? Hopefully it makes sense to people as they're listening to this. The idea of the culture war was done because in some sense the culture had, in their minds, swung so far that you didn't even need to be a Christian anymore to be part of the religious right. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't make any sense. And so the 94 is the beginning of this move where traditional values and conservatism sort of suddenly breaks away very abruptly from the mores that held it, the foundation that held it, this idea of evangelicalism. Once that happened, then fundamentalism actually gets moved from the mainstream to being a little bit of a sideline thing. And now it becomes sort of thing that politicians were pandering to sort of bring them along, but they didn't need them anymore mm-hmm. in 94. And so that lasts all the way to 2014. And that's the I'm going to totally mess this name is, but Obergefell.
That's just Obergefell, right?
It might be Obergefell. There's a G in it, and I don't know how to pronounce that G. But yeah, it's a unique last name. I don't know. But in this decision, marriage was no longer held in the Supreme Court no longer held marriage as strictly between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. It opened up the possibility for marriage to have a slightly different definition. And at that point in 2014, it wasn't that that was the date when the negative world started. It was the sign that the negative world had already started.
Yeah.
So if you go from let's imagine you're an evangelical in 2000, sorry, you're an evangelical in 1982. You know, Jimmy Carter lost his election. Ronald Reagan is probably not a practicing Christian to the extent that you maybe would like him to be, but he has leaned into the religious right, and he's sort of brought you along, and you're now in the center of power in 1981. Then all of a sudden, you get to 94, and it's like no longer does anybody really care what you have to say. It's just a neutral. Because they can get you, they can get the power without you, basically. Mm-hmm. And then you move to 2014, where now it's not even just that you don't have power; it's no one cares what you think, mm-hmm. even negatively toward you. And that move in 20 years was pretty significant. And now for the last 10, we've lived in this space where it feels like nobody really cares what Christians have to say. And I don't know about you, but a lot of times when I'm sharing my faith and talking about it, people say, "You're different than the others." And I think what they're saying there is it seems like you actually believe what you're saying you believe, mm-hmm. and you live it out. Whereas some of the people that they talk to or interact with maybe call themselves Christian but aren't actually living this faith out. And so I hear this a lot. "You're different. You're not what I expected." And in my mind, that's because I love Jesus. I'm spirit-led. I want to honor the Father with my life. And I do want to set that tone in my own life. And it goes back to that elder discussion back in the beginning of 1 Peter 5. I'm trying to take that seriously. I want to live my faith out day by day. I may not ever be able to pull that off, but I feel like I'm swimming in water that is very negative to me, whereas I wouldn't have felt that 25 years ago. And I didn't really start living for Jesus until the late 90s, and that transition was already beginning until the 2014 decision. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I've lived most of my Christian life either in neutral world into negative world. And it's made me not ambivalent to the culture war, but it's made me feel differently about the culture war.
Right. And I mean, that's a powerful statement that you say there. Like, you feel different. I think one of the pros of this whole shift is now that it's no longer popular and advantageous mm-hmm. to call yourself a Christian, if you're not actually a believer in Jesus, you're not going to call yourself a Christian. Whereas I think, you know, in the past generations, people called themselves Christians without being true followers of Jesus. Now, I don't know any individual's hearts, but I think just collectively, generally, that was happening more than it's happening today.
Yes.
Because one of the positives is if you call yourself a Christian, it's probably because you really own that. You really are a believer in Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where people are starting to see more like, because it's not popular, because it's more like what Christianity is like in a lot of the Eastern world right now,
yep.
where it's not cultural positive. It hasn't been cultural positive for years and years and years and years. If you're really going to you own that title, it's because you really believe it. You're not going to just do it as a matter of convenience. So there are some positives there, but I think internally in the church, one of the challenges, and this is what kind of the meat and potatoes, what I want to get at today yep. is I think what this has caused within the church community is now there is a tension that some people have felt between generations of believers, because you have a generation that lived in that positive land.
Yes.
And they saw the benefits of it. They were rewarded by those benefits. They saw how helpful it was that culture was pro-Christian. So they had something valuable, meaningful, and good, and it was lost. And they feel that loss. And they see culture around them slipping away and moving away. And they look at culture and they say, "We got to get this back. We had it. It was great. We need it back. How are we going to do that?" They see a lot of these pulls away, like the Obergefell decision that you're talking about. I remember, you know, a lot of George W. Bush's campaign speeches had to do with he wanted that amendment to the Constitution.
Sanctity of marriage.
Yeah, put the sanctity of marriage amendment, put it in the Constitution, one man, one woman. You can't—anything besides that is not is not legally marriage. And then, you know, he's out of office, and just a handful of years later, within one or two presidential terms, Supreme Court comes out with this decision. So it was that kind of idea. It's that kind of, we see these political things happening. Let's use that same mechanism to bring those things back. And so there's that mindset. But then if you look at me, I grew up in that neutral land.
Yep.
So I never had the positives. I never experienced those. I just kind of lived in this neutral land where it's like, yeah, it's okay. You know, that's made my experience of what are the solutions a little bit different, whereas I never had those great political legislative things in my pocket. So to go get them back, I'm not really pushing as hard for that. Like, I've seen it, and I've seen it go both ways, and it's like, okay, you know, that's where I'm at. But now specifically, the next generation that is coming up, the people that have grown into the adulthood in the last 10 years, so think of people that are in their, like, 20s, early 30s.
And, yeah, late millennials to Gen Z.
Yeah, yep. and actually, that's kind of where I am. I'm 35 right now, so they've never had it. They actually live in a culture more like what First Peter describes,
yes,
than the culture of the earlier generations, and so they never had it. And so they're looking around and they're saying, well, "Why do we have to fight so hard in these arenas? Why do we have to vote this way? Why do we have to like do some of these different things?" Because that's just been their experience. They're like, and it's not exactly one to one because it was different in Peter's day, but like what Peter's speaking to, Peter is speaking to people who have never lived in a pro-Christian culture, they live in an anti-Christian culture. They're suffering for their faith.
Yep.
Peter calls it the fiery trial. People are being killed for their faith, and they have absolutely no say in their government. And he's saying, hey, you are elect exiles. That's who you are. So here's how to live in your culture where you're always going to be the outcast. You're never going to fit in. And I think the younger generation, and I'm the older of that younger generation, are looking around and saying, yeah, that's us. Like, we've never had this. So to go and care about some of these other things, we're not completely there. And I think that creates tension in the church because that escalation of positive to neutral to negative happened so fast.
Yes.
It happened within a generation, you know, 20 years.
Yeah.
In 22 years, you went from, you were in negative or in positive to negative. And I, you know, so my where I'm going with all this is my encouragement as a church is that intergenerationally, we got to listen to one another and we have to understand. I don't want that tension to tear churches apart, because you can see that, especially when it gets into political season, because you have people who say, you know, we've seen those good things. Let's reform culture to be what I have experienced just 2 decades ago, which for a person in their 60s, 70s is not that long ago. And then you have a 25-year-old who has never experienced that 2 decades ago is their entire lifespan. And they're like, that's just never going to work. It's just never going to happen. I've never had it. I never want it. I never need it. I don't want that to create tension in the church. So I think understanding, communicating, and being on board with one solution, and the solution is the gospel, that unites us together, especially when these political tensions start coming, especially because political season's coming up.
Yeah, that was good. And there's a lot there to unpack, and we don't want to do that for the next 6 hours. So, but I think this is right where we're at, though. And I think what it makes people misunderstand is it may seem like younger generations aren't willing to put in the work or fight for what maybe older generations feel. This is important. We need to fight for this. And in some sense, the younger generations are looking around going, fight for what exactly? Because it may never come back. We may never get what you think is going to happen. And frankly, we've also lived in a world that, and we've talked about this in other podcasts and First Peter, we lived in a world that as long as I've been alive, everyone thinks it's the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of times that I've been told this is probably the end, you know? And
yeah, I remember I was in middle school at a Christian school having a discussion about how, hey, this could be the end times. Like, this would have been, what, like 2004, 2006?
Yeah.
Some of the things that were happening, this was just post 9/11.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, hey, this could be it.
And partly because most people listening to this podcast were born either just before or right after Israel became a nation again.
Yeah.
So people have assumed that that means this is what it is. It's going to happen. Here it is. And so just to add a little piece to this for you to think about, folks, as you listen to this, the reality is if we are moving toward the end, I expect things to get worse than better. So there's a part of my heart as well that I would love revival to come. Mm-hmm. I would love the political swing to happen where we're able to go, oh man, look what God is doing. Look at how our nation is gaining back its sense of its soul again, right? I would love to go back to the positive world toward Christianity. I'm not saying that I'm not convinced it'll never happen because God can bring revival. He can do whatever he wants to do. But to me, it's not even on the table because if we are moving toward the end, I don't think this is going to get better. I think if anything, it's going to get harder, in which Peter's words matter a ton to us. Live out your faith right now. It doesn't matter if anybody's for you. It doesn't matter if they're against you. It doesn't matter if they are fighting you tooth and nail. It doesn't matter if the fire trial comes. It doesn't matter if people are talking bad about you. It doesn't matter if, you know, your lifestyle looks so different that everybody treats you weird. Welcome to being in exile. Yeah. You have no power. You have no control. You have no – and I think what's – one more piece to add to this because, again, we could go on and on and on. But the last piece that I would like to add to this, and then we'll kind of wrap it up in a second, is this. The people who think that the positive world was because of them are not living out the humility that Peter's talking about to the elders here. The world that you grew up in was there because other people made the sacrifices to get that there. And they weren't even in control either. God is doing something that we can't fully imagine or understand. And you might say, why in the world would God let the world slowly slip away? He's not letting the world slip away. He's giving us the responsibility to live out his commands. And even while we were supposedly doing that in the positive world, it wasn't being done to the extent that it should have been. Mm-hmm. Christians were way too excited about war, way too excited about certain things that don't line up with the values of Jesus. It slipped away because it was bound to slip away. And if it comes back, it's not because we did it. It's because God wants to bring it back.
Right, right. And you know, I'm glad you brought up revival. Like, nothing short of revival. So I think there is still hope for that. So, absolutely. You know, I can only speak for my generation. I can't speak for the generations before me. But if we want to that life that was lost, that culture that was lost, it comes from revival. It comes from the gospel changing people's lives, and then those individuals would change lives, joining the community of believers to then change the culture.
Not a Supreme Court.
Right.
Not a legislative branch that agrees with you. Not a president.
Not a president. Not even not an amendment to the Constitution. All those things, sure, would be great. And I would love to have them. But at least, you know, my generation says, well, we never had those, so we don't expect to have them. However, revival can bring those things.
Absolutely.
Because I think the other thing is these challenges that we're facing are localized right now to our country. You look at the Global South, and the gospel is just running rampant in the Global South. Like, that is great. And so we tend to look at some situations around us. We feel these pressures. We feel this negativity, and we think, oh, man, like, Satan is really at work here. Mm-hmm. And yes, he is. And the Lord is really at work globally. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that brings me comfort. Again, being in my generation, never having had those things, I think it's easier for me to be in this elect exile mindset. But sometimes I forget that the Lord brings revival.
Yep.
And so how do all revivals start? Start with prayer. Mm-hmm. And so if that's where we're going, that's where I can wrap up. My last thing to say is let's be people of prayer, and not just praying that an individual will get elected, although that can help, not just praying that a piece of legislation will get passed, that can help, not just praying that the Supreme Court will make a decision. All those things can help. I'm not saying don't do those things, but let's be people who pray for revival, pray for the gospel, pray for revival in people's hearts. That's the solution to this problem.
Yep. And I think we've said it before. Our goal is to make disciples. And what Jesus says in Acts 1:8 is, you're going to be my witnesses. Stay in your lane. I'm not bringing the kingdom the way you think. it's coming, but not in the way you expect.